This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And show Monday through Friday on KBOO. What does this mean in terms of airtime? To meet the needs of the outcast liberal progressives in Portland? 15 hours out of the 168 hours, KBOO is on the air each week. Please go to kboo.fm and look for Tom Hartman on KBOO, then take this two-question survey. If you are not currently a member, please join us today. Pass the link along to others. We need to hear from the entire community if we are to make informed decisions. Please understand that this is only an informational gathering survey to guide possible future programming changes. Please contact me if you have questions or concern. My door is always open. This has been KBOO Station Manager, Development Director, Executive Director, and Ever Watchful Navigator, Lynn Fitch. Thanks.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, it's Health and Healthcare Forum. Host Roberta Hall speaks with Dr. Melinda Manure, Professor of Nutrition and Exercise Sciences at Oregon State University, about energy balance research and applications. She also interviews four participants in a recent session at the Pauling Institute, which does research and teaching on nutrition, micronutrients, and health. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Comments can be addressed to me at rhall@oregonstate.edu. My guest today is Melinda Manure, and she's a professor of nutrition and exercise science here at Oregon State University. So welcome, Melinda.
Thank you.
I attended a lecture that you gave called Rethinking Energy Balance and Healthy Eating, Sorting Fact from Fiction. You raised a lot of interesting issues. Let me first ask you, how did you get attracted into this field?
So when I was doing my PhD in nutrition with a minor in exercise science and an interest in the interaction of nutrition and exercise on health, I was actually studying vitamin B6. In the research that I was doing, we had active and sedentary women, young and old, and we were feeding them everything they ate for 7 weeks and collecting all of their urine for 7 weeks. We had a specially designed diet because we were monitoring vitamin B6, so it was to give them the recommended dietary allowance of vitamin B6. And we are looking to see if you exercise more, does your requirement for vitamin B6 go up? Because it's very important for carbohydrate and protein metabolism, which would be enhanced if you were physically active. So what we were doing is changing the level of carbohydrate in the diet. What I observed is when we changed the diet, even though we were being somewhat clandestine, we didn't want our participants to know we were changing the makeup of the diet. When we moved from a diet that was more processed to a diet that was less processed and a little bit lower in fat with more fiber, we were monitoring the calories every day and monitoring their weight. And what we noticed is when we moved to this diet that was a little less processed and a little more whole carbohydrates like whole grain bread and more vegetables and brown rice, that our participants who had been on a previous diet and maintaining their weight kept saying, I can't eat all the food you're giving me. You're giving me too much food. I can't eat it all. Well, we knew the calories hadn't changed.
Oh, wonderful.
We only knew that the type of food we were feeding was different. Mm-hmm. And we needed them to eat all the food every day because we couldn't let them lose weight. The goal of this study was to maintain your weight. Mm-hmm. And they were coming in and saying, you're giving me too much food. I can't eat it all.
Oh.
And we knew that we weren't giving him any more calories. And so to me, it was not part of what we were studying. It was a different research question, but it was always amazing to me that without changing the calories, just changing the forms of the food, people were saying, I'm full. I'm satisfied. I can't eat any more food. And they were losing weight. That was the problem. They were losing weight because we were monitoring their weight and we were thinking, you've got to eat all the food because we need you to eat. We can't let you lose weight. At the same time, when we were doing the study, we had people who exercised and people who didn't exercise in the study.
And you kept track of that.
And we kept track of that, and we didn't want it to change. We wanted our sedentary people to stay sedentary and our active people to stay active. Well, they ate meals together, and the active people would come in and say, oh, I'm running this race this weekend, and I'm doing this, which made our sedentary people want to start doing stuff. And we're saying, no, we need you to stay this way until the study's over. But it really made me realize also the sort of carryover enthusiasm of people who were active and really liked what they were doing in terms of just being more fit. And these other individuals wanting to participate.
Oh, my gosh.
So that sort of crossover effect, which we, at the time, did not anticipate. And this was quite a while ago.
And you didn't anticipate that weight loss would be part of it.
And people saying, I'm full. Yeah. I can't eat anymore. I'm satisfied.
Oh, that kind of a study would get you hooked on the research.
Yeah. So it was totally something different than I had started out to look at. But it really made me very interested in this whole concept of energy balance. How many calories people think they need to eat? Mm-hmm. Because people will come in and say that they are maintaining their weight on a lot fewer calories than I think they should. And when we actually feed you, we know how many calories you need. Because we weigh every single food. We know exactly what you're consuming. So it was extremely interesting. And so because of that, I have sort of followed some level of energy balance, and energy balance crosses the spectrum. Mm-hmm. We finished a study where we needed women to eat more. Oh. We finished a study where we wanted women to eat less. It depends on their body size, their fitness level, whether we're trying to lose weight because they were sedentary and at risk for chronic disease, or because they were too thin because they were exercising so much. Mm-hmm. And when you exercise more than you're feeding yourself, you have chronic disease issues just like people at the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So it crosses the spectrum. We got people who need to lose weight, and we do have some people who need to gain weight, or people who just need to not worry so much about their weight and just get more fit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's an awful lot of us. So how long did you keep that first study going, and how long do you often do a study with individuals where you're totally controlling what they eat?
That particular study was 7 weeks long.
7 weeks. That can feel like a long time,
I guess. Yes, and remember, we were feeding very, very similar foods every single day for 7 weeks. It gets a little monotonous. And we do that because it makes it a little easier for us to control everything.
Sure.
And then we didn't have a huge kitchen, mm-hmm. And we didn't have a huge staff, which is required if you do more foods. I've done other feeding studies like this. When I was in Arizona, I finished a study where we did 5 different interventions, each of them 7 weeks long, feeding everything.
Wow.
And collecting all the urine.
All the urine? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, they couldn't leave for too great a distance from where they're supposed to be, I guess.
Well, they would carry
a little bottle
and
or something.
Fill it up and bring it in every morning.
My goodness.
For 7 weeks. So
dedicated.
Yes, dedicated. And then we did just finish an intervention, a weight loss fitness intervention study in premenopausal women who were overweight and abdominally obese, meaning their waist circumference was too large. In that study, we had an intervention that was 16 weeks, but we didn't provide all the food. We checked in with them every week. You know, they weighed in. We were pretty active with them. And they came to an exercise class that we monitored 3 times a week. So we saw them a lot.
You mentioned belly fat and talked about that in the lecture that I attended. That has to do with some bad effects on the liver, I know, but would you explain a little bit more why belly fat is so problematic and what are the factors that produce it in individuals, both men and women?
All right, so the reason that we talk about abdominal body fat or belly fat is that around your waist, you have 2 different kinds of fat. And the way I like to explain it is you have the fat around your waist that you can pinch with your fingers.
Mm-hmm. Subcutaneous.
That's subcutaneous fat. And then we have the fat that's internal around the organs, which we call visceral fat. And you can't see that unless you do a CAT scan or you can measure it with a DEXA. So you can't see that. But the reason that fat is detrimental is that because it's close to your organs, especially your liver, when that fat is broken down into its individual fatty acids, it can go right into the liver. The liver, depending on how it handles that fat, can actually increase the amount of fat that's in the liver itself, which makes it start to act abnormally.
Oh, dear.
Also, those fatty acids that go into the liver can impact the amount of insulin that is in the blood. And so if you have too much insulin and you're overweight and you're insensitive to insulin, and so you're, even though you have a lot of insulin, your blood glucose is still high. And then it also has something to do with your body not handling carbohydrates very well and making fat and putting that fat in the liver. So
that visceral fat is the real problem.
Yes, and it seems to be very much connected to chronic disease. Now, the other factor is that many people who are overweight have a lot of fat around their waist, and they have a lot of subcutaneous fat, but they also may have a lot of visceral fat. So just losing weight for most people will reduce that somewhat.
Ah, just plain losing weight.
But yeah, the study we did, we particularly picked women who were overweight, but also tended to put more fat around their waist because it's a risk factor for hypertension, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. These were young women who were already overweight, and as they age, as they go through menopause, all of those factors just tend to get worse if you don't do something about them. Our hypothesis was it would be better to interact and intervene earlier.
Early.
Because it only seems to get harder and harder to lose weight when you get older. At least most people will tell you that.
Yeah.
And I think from a personal experience, I have to believe that too. Maybe we just struggle more with it. I don't know.
Yeah. And as you get older, your organs reduce in size, I've been told. And then, of course, for women, you have the other issue that menstruation uses up calories.
Well, and as people get older, they tend to be less active and they tend to lose lean tissue. And lean tissue is more metabolically demanding than fat tissue. And so if you just keep eating the same number of calories, but you don't need as many,
you're in trouble.
You're probably going to gain weight, and it's not going to be lean tissue.
No.
Also true that where you put your fat down, so when you gain weight, where do you gain that extra fat, is probably highly besides gender, genetically determined. Mm-hmm. You can sort of look at your family and say, okay, when our family puts on weight, this is where my mom puts mm-hmm. it on, or, you know, there's some sort of genetic resemblance there.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think we just have to appreciate that we can't really tell someone's body composition necessarily by looking at them.
Mm-hmm. And that's where things like the bod pod, for instance, come in, which is kind of the air equivalent of the old water test.
Yes. It's sort of the simpler version of mm-hmm. underwater weighing. The gold standard is to do a DEXA assessment. So you're not only getting your lean tissue and your fat tissue, mm-hmm. but you're also getting your bone. And remember, people age, mm-hmm. they tend to lose bone,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is another reason why you can be a little bit deceived by your body composition, because now your bones have actually gotten lighter.
Oh, dear.
And on the scale, you don't know that.
Mm-hmm. No.
So you say, well, the scale hasn't changed. Well, I know your bones have probably gotten a little bit lighter as you've aged because you've lost bone density. Mm-hmm. So where's that extra weight gone? Well, maybe it's gone to fat. If your scale hasn't changed, I mean, it's got to go someplace. So
there are lots of ways to look. It's sort of easy, superficial step on the scale.
And that's
helpful.
It is helpful to monitor your weight. Mm-hmm. But I think when you start losing weight, like people want to lose weight, mm-hmm. you have to realize that when you lose weight, the weight loss comes from a lot of different sources, especially early in the diet. For example, those first 2 or 3 weeks where you're losing weight and the scale is changing, you are mm-hmm. probably losing some water weight. You're probably losing glycogen, which is your stored carbohydrate stores.
You have to stay longer and stay with it longer to lose the fat? Is that part of the message?
Part of that message is right now, most people know that if you want to lose a pound of body weight, notice I said weight,
mm-hmm.
you have to somehow reduce by 3,500 calories. And somehow we think this is a magic number. But I think there's mm-hmm. been more and more data looking at how many calories do you actually need to lose a pound of body weight. And remember, when you lose weight, what's the composition of that weight? It's not all fat.
Mm,
and we would like it all to be fat, and we want the majority of it to be fat.
Mm-hmm.
But we know some of it's going to be water.
Mm-hmm.
We know some of it is going to be lean tissue.
Mm.
We know some of it's going mm-hmm. to be glycogen, especially early in the weight loss process. And then over time, it could be bone.
Mm.
You know, over a longer period of time. So it seems like you get closer and closer to that 3,500 calories per pound, maybe after you've been on the diet for 4 weeks.
Oh, dear.
Or 5 weeks. So, and it mm-hmm. may be that if you and I went on the same diet with the same relative energy deficit,
mm-hmm.
you're going to reduce your calories by 25% from what you need right now, and I'm going to reduce my calories by 25%. Mm-hmm. Assuming that our energy expenditure didn't change, we may not lose weight exactly the same.
Okay.
And people don't appreciate that what mm-hmm. you might need mm-hmm. in terms of weight loss could be different than what I
mm-hmm. need. Let's talk a little more about the in utero experience, because another thing that you brought up at the lecture was, of course, we have genetics and then we have epigenetics. The epigenetics is something that affects the gene expression, but isn't part of the DNA, but can be picked up in utero, certainly, with certain drugs, maybe prescription drugs, mind you, or recreational drugs, either one, or other substances that we may not think of as drugs.
Yeah, so I mean, it could be a nutrient mm-hmm. that we get more mm-hmm. of or less of or deficient mm-hmm. in. So it may be the drugs that we're consuming. It may be the interaction between mm-hmm. a drug and a nutrient. So I think the one thing we know is that there's so many dynamic things happening in utero, and mm-hmm. those cells are dividing so rapidly. There's so much growth that we need to make sure we have all mm-hmm. the sort of building blocks
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that the body needs for mm-hmm. healthy development of all the organs and tissues, and that it does make a difference what you consume.
Mm-hmm. This relates something else that I think is very interesting that has to do with blaming the victim. Sometimes it's said, well, I'm not going to help that person with their health care because they're fat.
That's a great issue, and it's one that I am pretty passionate about in terms of how I feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so many factors that decide why we are the way we are, the mm-hmm. size we are. We have more and more children who are overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we know that young children going into the teens and going into adulthood, if they're overweight, there's a much greater probability they're going to be overweight adults.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start with an overweight adult, and then we add our very sedentary lifestyle that most of us do in terms of work, which is a lot of times sitting mm-hmm. in front of a computer, not moving much during the day. And at the same time, with the women, we may add 1, 2, or 3 pregnancies,
mm-hmm.
which can mm-hmm. increase mm-hmm. weight if you don't lose that weight. And then we can add stress, and a lot of people eat under stress. We can add poor economy so that maybe you don't have the money to buy healthier foods.
Sure.
Because right. you can get a lot of calories for mm-hmm. not much money, but they may not be very nutrient-dense calories. And then I think on top of that, we are 2, maybe 3 generations removed from people who really know how to cook.
Mm.
So they may not have the skills to take more of the raw foods. If you don't have much money and it's cheaper to cook it yourself, but you don't have those skills, you don't know how mm-hmm. to take ingredients that are relatively inexpensive because they haven't been processed, they're not already cooked for you. I don't know when I see someone, I don't know all the factors that why they are the way they are. And I can say in the weight loss world and in the world of working with women, because I've done a lot with women across the life cycle, when you hear their stories, you want to stop and say, I just don't know if I could deal with all this.
Yeah.
I was at a meeting one time with a very, very, very large woman speaking about weight. She told her story. She probably was 400 or 500 pounds. When she got done, I don't think there was a dry eye in the audience.
Oh, I bet.
Here's a kid who was a little bit overweight as a baby. And at the time, the doctors started putting this child on amphetamines at 5 or 6 or 7 years old.
Amphetamines.
To lose weight.
Mm.
A mother that constantly thought, to do the right thing, I've got to restrict my child. So here's someone, her whole adult life has fought with food mm-hmm. from the youngest mm-hmm. age.
Mm.
And if you speak with many women and you ask them about their early experiences, and this just surprised me one time when I was speaking to a group of third graders, and they started telling me all about diets. And whether the other kid was skinny or fat. And I'm going, how do you know all of this?
Yeah.
In the third grade. Oh, my mom's on a diet. My aunt's on a diet. My sister's on a diet. So I think we forget the influence that women have on younger women.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have young kids on the playground calling each other names and women trying to look like the magazine picture.
Oh, yeah.
I just think we have so many pressures on women, and now the same pressures seem to be appearing for men, to look a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So when I see someone who's overweight, and let's say they're trying to exercise and do better, and they're out exercising, and people will yell at them and make fun of them.
Oh, my.
I just get so upset, because I think here's someone who's really trying to work at being healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to run prior to a few accidents that put me out of running commission. And I've never been a real large individual. And even I remember running, and people, men on bikes and boys on bikes would go by and make all sorts of, call you names and make fun of you.
Oh.
You know, tell you to go faster or slower or whatever.
Yeah.
And I can remember still being upset with them. And I was in college when this would happen. And I keep thinking, there's so many people who are overweight that don't want to go out in public and make these efforts to change because they're embarrassed. Or there's someone's going to make mm-hmm. a comment. So mm-hmm. I just think we all have to say, regardless of what size you are, I think we can all make healthier changes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's hard to do. And part of it is we need our environment to help us make those changes.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know,
instead of activities that confine us to a desk, but activities that make us walk around sometimes or something to that effect.
Allow us to you know, be more active, and also our kids. I mean, our kids are growing up sitting in front of their computers mm-hmm. or screen, some mm-hmm. kind of a screen,
mm-hmm.
and they're not getting out. And parents don't want them out because they don't want them out by themselves, or it's not safe.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
So I just think that we have to help people. If they're overweight, I mean, I see these people lose 50, 60, 70 pounds, and I think, I don't know if I could do that. I admire how hard they've worked. And the female participants in the last study about making healthy lifestyle choices, it was about exercise. It was about teaching them how to make better food selections. It was not about trying to go on a 1,000-calorie diet. It was about how can you make healthier choices when you go to the store and bring all those same choices home to your whole family. And I can tell you, many of those women have been on repeated diets. And so they get tired of failing. You know, and that whole cycle of, here's another diet and I fail again.
And where do all these diets come from? You wonder, who are they directed to, and do people make money by promoting such diets, or what is the impetus?
I would say that the majority, yes, people make money because those diets come and go. The books sell, and then they're, 2 years later, that's old hat and there's another one. I do think there are some that are very good, and the one that we followed when we did our study is really trying to follow what we call a low energy dense diet, which means you're eating foods that have a relatively high water content.
Oh.
And they have fewer calories per gram. So in essence, for every bite of food, they have fewer calories. So the example is you're eating the grapes instead of the raisins. The grapes take up a lot of space because they have a lot of water in them, and the raisins have been dry. Not that there's anything wrong with raisins. It's just that I can eat a cup or 2 cups of grapes. Those same grapes, if they were dry, might be a quarter of a cup.
Right, right.
And so the grapes are going to fill up my stomach. The apple's going to fill up my stomach. The whole grains are going to fill me up more. And if my stomach feels fuller, we have all these hormones in our gut that send signals to our brain that says, hey,
stop.
You're full. You're satisfied. You know, eating a little slower. So if you eat more slowly and you stretch out your stomach and these receptors in your gut send signals to the brain and the hormones send signals to the brain, it takes a little time for that to happen. If you eat a little more slowly, your brain will say, hey, I'm full. Stop. So Dr. Barbara Rolls from Penn State University, and she's an endowed chair there, she has done a fair amount of research in this area, and she actually wrote a book called The Volumetric Diet. And it's really based on good research and then saying, for example, instead of eating 2 Oreos for dessert, if you were eating low energy dense foods, you would eat a bowl of strawberries with a little bit of yogurt on them. You know, something that just takes up more space.
More space in the stomach and a little more time, too.
A little
more
time.
You would enjoy it perhaps a little longer.
And it's healthy for you. And so trying to teach people how to make good food choices, not counting calories all the time and not putting you on some sort of restricted diet or saying you have to take this particular diet food. Just trying to make better choices. So, and then I can't let you stop this program without talking about exercise.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because I think people only think of exercise as a way to burn calories. And what they don't understand is that there are so many health benefits to being physically active on top of the fact that it does burn some calories. So, for example, it can help maintain your lean tissue. If your lean tissue is maintained, your whole energy expenditure is higher, your rest and metabolic rate is higher, you are able to be more free living. You can get out of a chair. You can do the activities of daily living easier. We also know that it can reduce your blood pressure. It can reduce your risk of diabetes and insulin sensitivity. It can reduce your risk of hypertension. I mean, there's just,
And the brain.
And
and
oxygen to the brain, as well as reduce your risk of osteoarthritis and having all those joints replaced. I mean, there's so many, and the whole psychological piece.
Sure.
We know that exercise can work as well as some medications to help with depression and just the way it makes you feel more upbeat. That I just can't emphasize enough that we have to pay a little attention to what we eat. And we have to pay a little attention to getting up and moving.
Getting up and moving and doing things.
It doesn't have to just be programmed physical activity where you say, I'm going to go out and run, or I'm going to get on my bike, or I'm going to go for a walk. something we call non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and it is just moving more during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Standing up, moving around, not spending more than a half an hour in one spot.
You get up and you go out and you get a drink of water or you get some fresh air or something like
yes.
that.
You know, we're just in a society that is so tied to our screens. Mm. So a lot of people will say, well, I just don't have time. And I'm saying, well, you don't have time not to do this if you care about your long-term health. But as a parent and as someone that could impact the lives of children, you don't have time not to be a good example.
That's true, too.
You know, I think we just have to be creative in how we get active. In our study, we gave people pedometers just to help them get that feedback, and their kids got into it. Mom, I want one. Mom, how many steps do you have? Did you get your steps today? Let's go for one.
Wow.
You know, so a little competition, a little, and the feedback, because I think sometimes we just don't realize how much we do sit. More and more, we're trying to encourage people to spread those calories out. Don't eat them all at one time, and especially don't eat them all at night, because your body needs those nutrients all day long. Then you're providing those nutrients to your body throughout the day, especially the protein to the lean tissue, so you can build and repair. So instead of being the one big mealer, spread those calories out.
We covered pretty well what dynamic energy balance means, that things can change.
And I think the other take-home message is when you say, I'm going to diet and I'm going to change calories, as soon as you change calories, you change energy expenditures. So there's a lot of things that are going on that you can't necessarily measure.
Well, thank you very much, Melinda Menor.
You're welcome.
Enjoyed talking with you.
I did too.
It's Saturday, May 18th, and we're talking here at Oregon State University, where the Linus Pauling Institute, LPI, is located. Linus Pauling gave his papers to this institution, which he and his wife both graduated from, and that's where they met. So it's a major center for Linus Pauling-related work, and of course he was very interested in nutrition. The Linus Pauling Institute is offering a public session called Diet and Optimum Health. And there are speakers, and there are also displays. And right now, I'm talking to Don Dumont, and he's here with one of the displays. Tell us what you're doing here.
Okay, I'm one of the writers for a website called Live to Age Well. And that's the number 2, livetoagewell.com. And we write articles about diet and nutrition. We're actually paid to do this from Roman Meal, and every one of our articles is checked by Roman Meal for accuracy, and also we submit to LPI so they can look over and make sure that everything is correct for them. We like to use scientific information from LPI to explain the points that we talk about in our articles.
Well, it's interesting to talk to you because I talk to a lot of people about health in doing this health and healthcare forum that I do and have done for the last 5 years. But it's very rare that I talk to anyone who's a writer about these topics. I noticed today, and we certainly can't disagree with it, that the diet area, nutrition area, is so full of faddish diets, fad writings, and sometimes people on the news summarizing a scientific study and exaggerating the results, whether they're negative or positive, and drawing policy. They've had a bit of roasting.
What most radio stations, TV stations are looking for is that sound bite, explaining something in 8 to 10 seconds. What we do for our articles is we take the scientific information and act kind of as a bridge to just the regular people. We want to make it in simple language, but we want to make sure they understand, you know, why they should be doing something or why they could be doing something, and make it more palatable, so to speak.
Well, the radio station that this program is part of is great because it does allow lengthy conversations rather than sound bites. I'm really happy that you're doing that.
What we started doing about a month and a half ago was including a little video at the end of an article. It makes it nice.
Many different ways to use food and to do it in a way that makes it educational, informative, fun, humorous, and probably a lot more, as they would say at this conference, nutrient dense, and also having the volume so that it's not energy dense. So how long have you been writing about nutrition?
We started last August. I've been interested in food since I almost burned my parents' house down making bacon when I was in the first grade.
So it got better after that, right?
Well, let's hope it did.
Well, tell us about the whole foods aspect, because this particular session is called Whole Food Approaches to Disease Prevention. And we've had papers this morning on prevention of cardiometabolic disease, the metabolic syndrome, which you usually think of as primarily diabetes and insulin resistance, but the tendency now is just to think of it together. What is Roman Meal? It's an old company, and I was just intrigued by seeing the display, partly because it's harder to get some of those old products. That reminded me that Roman Meal used to have cereal, cooked cereal with lots of good stuff in it. So is that still the case?
Kind of. Roman Meal celebrated their 100th anniversary here about 4 or 5 months ago. And so they've been around as a company for Roman Meal that much time. But the family that owns it, the Matei family, their history goes back in baking to, I think, the 1600s in Germany.
Wow. So you write for this website, and is it always updated with new research information, or how can people, I'm just thinking of how people who are listening to this can use it?
We have a team that we work with at Roman Meal, and we discuss what type of articles would be best placed on there. I started looking at what was being touted as superfoods.
What is in your superfood group?
The first presentation this morning was about whole grains and nuts.
Right.
And those are both the superfoods. And after listening to the presentation this morning, I'm thinking, I need to write another couple articles about the whole grains and the walnuts.
All of the speakers are emphasizing that you should get these particular substances, whether it's polyphenols or omega-3s, in food as a first preference. And then if you absolutely cannot get them, a supplement is a possibility.
I liked what they said, food first.
Food first, yeah.
The woman said, I'm a nutritionist and I always go food first. And then if you can't get it, look for the supplement.
Yeah, and I think that's been a very consistent message. Is the connection between what you're doing and the Linus Pauling Institute, is it because Roman Meal provides some of the funding for some of the research here, or what is the linkage there?
I think it's for 2 years now, the Roman Meal Company has been helping support the Linus Pauling Institute and especially their healthy aging program. And the owner, chairman of the board of Roman Meal, is 93, and he has been insistent upon making sure that people understand that nutrition should start as a child and then build in through the years as they grow older. And by doing the proper nutrition at all the way along there, then you have reduced diabetes, you have reduced blood pressure, you have reduced almost every risk. I find that both charming and very helpful in the state of our economy and healthcare system right now.
This is very unusual to have a large company that's really a family that's been with it for a long time. I suppose it's a public corporation now, or a corporation that sells stock, or is it not?
I don't think it is.
Still private.
Still private.
Mm-hmm.
They have a combination of Roman Meal and then the mill, which is in North Dakota.
It's also, of course, very hard to find a company that has legacy, has a history as long as that. And it's kind of what the country is looking for now, is to have, you know, real owners who are interested in the product from the beginning and continue to be interested in the product and not just in exchanging pieces of paper and making money.
Well, I think the Roman Meal Company has always been interested in nutrition and what they can do to help people. So it continues with that legacy right now. One of the things that have been touched on today a couple times in the presentations is BMI, Body Mass Index.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that the owner, Charles Matei, wants to do for the school lunch program. This is something he tried to push about 3 years ago, and it was about trying to get the school system to look at what they're doing with the school lunch programs, as well as checking the BMI for the students all the way through, so you can have them check and see how they are in the first grade, second grade, third grade, and that kind of look at the scale to see if it's going to continue that way or if they can control it.
It's been delightful talking to you, and thank you, Don Doman.
Well, it was fun.
At a luncheon following its public presentations on May 18th, Linus Pauling Institute scientists and staff gave a brief introduction to their research. I had a chance to talk with three of them about their work. These applied and basic research projects directly relate to research goals that the Linus Pauling Institute has identified as very important. I'm talking to one of the people who helps with the Healthy Youth Program in gardening. And Mary, what is your name? Mary Cole?
Mary Cole.
Right?
I'm a garden assistant at the Healthy Youth Program.
And you work with the high school students?
I work at the elementary school garden at Lincoln Elementary in South Corvallis. Mm-hmm. But we also run another garden out of Corvallis High School.
It's an area that I walk by quite often, and I'm very impressed with the garden.
Yeah, so that garden is more of like a production garden, where a lot of the food that they grow is going to be given to the kids that are at the high school to eat, like in their cafeteria. Oh. But we have a little bit of that going on at Lincoln, but it's more of a learning garden.
Oh.
And we're actually expanding the Lincoln Elementary School garden right now to have the Healthy Youth Program Family Sharing Garden.
Oh, wow. Which,
yeah, so that's the difference between the community garden and the sharing garden is that everybody comes and helps and learns together, and then they can take some of the produce instead of having a separate plot. Like each person having a separate plot,
right.
It's like we will have like a different area for different things to grow. So there are a lot of advantages to that.
So a person who isn't a gardener but lives in the neighborhood, has a child at school or something, could benefit from it.
Yeah, so it's open to not just the Lincoln Elementary School parents, but also just anyone that lives in the community or is interested in getting involved.
Where do you think this is going in the long run? That is to say, what will this do for kids and where will they go with it? And where do you want it to go with it for yourself?
Well, hopefully down the road, the kids that are involved in any of our programs are going to be learning about cooking food, how to cook food, and how to eat healthy food, and maybe how to grow it, where it comes from, so that there's more of a connection between, like, seeing a plant growing in a field and then turning that into a healthy meal. And hopefully down the road, that just makes them, you know, healthier, live better lives, longer, healthier lives. The Linus Pauling Institute's purpose, basically.
Where is it going with you?
So I am a student at OSU right now, and I'm majoring in horticulture. And this, I'm actually graduating in less than a month.
Oh, boy.
So I hope to continue doing stuff with garden education, preferably in urban areas, serving underprivileged communities I'm mostly interested in. And I really enjoy working with kids.
Yeah, very good.
And in the Portland area, hopefully, that's where I'm going.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Of course.
We're talking at the LPI luncheon and just continuing a conversation. And one of the faculty members and researchers here at the LPI is Merit Traber. And she just introduced her areas of interest as vitamin E, for one thing. And then a very interesting word, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce right now.
Oh, metabolomics.
Metabolomics. Okay, so it would be the study of metabolism, right?
Yes.
Very good. And tell us how that's done and why it has burst on the scene. Is it more comprehensive than other metabolic studies, or what is the attraction?
So the traditional way of doing studies is to start with a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. I think vitamin E is good for you because la, la, la. That means that when I do my study and la, la, la does not happen, I've failed.
I can't write a paper. Nothing happens. Everybody's disappointed. We wasted all kinds of money. Now, if you back up and say, I have no idea what vitamin E does, but I think it's important because you die if you don't have enough. So if I now take a situation where somebody has vitamin E and somebody does not, and we measure everything. And when I say measure everything, it's all the metabolites in the blood, or all the metabolites in the urine, or all the metabolites in any given tissue. And then I compare them. And I don't need to know what it is. These are little peaks on a chromatogram, and I just match them. If they're the same size, I'm not interested. But if vitamin E increases one peak fourfold, and I can now go, wow, what is that? Why is it changing? And we have equipment. We have equipment that allows us to measure 10,000, 50,000 different chemicals, and we can then say, all right, which ones changed? Why are they important? Can I make a hypothesis about specific markers we've never seen before? So it is a whole new approach to thinking about the problem.
Just let me ask one question. I can probably ask a dozen, actually, very easily, right? But in these two individuals, and you, one person does not have vitamin E, you know that. Now, is that because the other person is being given a supplement, or is it in their diet?
Well, that was a kind of easy example using vitamin E. You really need to design your experiment very well. It's like you use rats that are identical genetic background. You feed them identical diets except for one thing. So that part of the experimentation is the same. You can do the same kind of experiment with people by saying, I want this group of people to eat only a high-fat diet for 6 months. We'll take their blood, then we'll have a washout period, and then we'll feed them a high-carbohydrate diet for 6 months, and we'll take their blood. And then in the same people, compare the samples.
Okay.
So you can use a variety of experimental designs, but it's how you measure things and what questions you ask at the outset that make things different.
And if you use the same people, then they're their own control, so
exactly,
to speak.
Exactly.
And presumably their behavior is the same. I mean, their same routine mainly, and mostly the same exercise and so forth.
Exactly. And of course, to get people to do the same things ever twice is always hard, but you encourage what kinds of behaviors you'd like.
Yeah, and you do it for a long enough time that one strange day doesn't screw everything up.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, but you have a particular interest, you said, in vitamin E. What is the reason for that? What is your understanding that it may contribute?
So what I can tell you is I've been studying vitamin E probably for over 25 years.
Oh, my.
I just got an award for studying vitamin E, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
I got into it because about the late 80s, there was a description of neurologic abnormalities in children. They couldn't walk because who knew why? And when they measured, they found that vitamin E in their plasma was very low. So blood vitamin E is very low. And this is extremely rare. Most people have very normal looking blood. And so the explanation of what happened was that they were missing a protein in their livers that actually regulates vitamin E. So I've been looking at, how do you regulate vitamin E? What is it important for? Turns out to be expressed in the brain.
Oh.
And the brain retains vitamin E and protects you.
Ah. So, you know, that reminded me of Linus Pauling's mother had a deficiency that wasn't known, and that made her behave in a crazy way. It's a very sad story. The vitamin E story you're telling is a little different, but very similar.
Well, I think it took a long time to discover
what are the vitamin E deficiency symptoms?
The other question I have was, what foods might it be found in?
Oh, nuts and seeds, so almonds, okay. Sunflower seeds, and olive oil.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so we
Very
were
accessible.
Hearing this week that a liter of olive oil is what you ought to eat, but you need to replace your fat with olive oil.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And your topic, of course, is cutting edge research, and you're looking at a category of nutrients that most people, I don't think, pay much attention to, but it's a very interesting plant. Hops. We have hops growing in our backyard. It's just a nice vine that goes up and attaches to a roof and makes a nice little screen. The idea was it was supposed to screen out the sun. Well, it hasn't done that yet. But it's attractive and interesting to watch it grow. Tell me, your name is Fred Stevens, and you're from the Netherlands, and you're here in Oregon for how long?
This is my second time.
Your second time?
I was here first from 95 until 99 as a postdoc.
Ah.
And then it was for 3 years back in the old world, first in Amsterdam for 1 year and 2 years in East Germany, in Halle and the Saale.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back here at Oregon State as a faculty member.
And you're in pharmacy, you said.
Yeah, my academic home is in the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University, and I have do my research here with colleagues in the Linus Pauling Institute.
So you're really in the Linus Pauling Institute most of the time. Of
right,
your
my office
work
and my time. Laboratory is in the Linus Pauling Institute.
And you're working on a category that I won't even try to pronounce. So could you tell me what it is?
Oh, you were asking about xanthohumol.
Xanthohumol,
yeah.
And that would be spelled how?
Well, it's from the Greek. It's xanthos, and that means yellow.
Okay.
And humol is from humulus. That's the genus name of the hop plant.
Oh, good.
And the ol, the ending ol, stands for alcohol. So it's a polyphenol from the hops plant with a yellow color.
Ah. And how long has this been identified? Been known of for a long, long time by chemists and
The first publication was in 1913. That was the name xanthohumol was coined. Was published in the Journal of the Chemical Society in London, England. Of course, at that time, they didn't know what it was, and that's how they called it xanthohumol.
Oh.
But they knew it was a polyphenol.
Mm.
And, of course, the structure was not elucidated at that time. And then in the 1960s, when there was more chemical methods for structure elucidation, they elucidated structure, and the structure was known. But the brewers, they didn't pay any attention to it because it wasn't bitter, had no bitter taste.
So it was okay from a brewing standpoint.
It was. They didn't pay attention to it as an interesting compound. But in the mid-1990s, we became involved in polyphenol from hops, and then we isolated the xanthohumol again and then tested it in biological activity assays and then found it had cancer chemopreventive activities.
Oh, boy.
So we published a number of papers on that, and the brewers were very happy about it, of course. But there is very little of the xanthohumol in beer, so just from drinking beer, you'll never, ever, ever get the health benefits from xanthohumol. Now, that does mean that we're not interested in it because you can still get xanthohumol from the spent hops. That is how it's produced by the hop industry. And it is used as a nutraceutical supplement, for instance. And now we're interested lately, in the last couple of years, in the effects of xanthohumol on a thing called metabolic syndrome. It's not a disease, but people have and high blood pressure and they have glucose intolerance, insulin insensitivity, obesity, and chronic inflammation. And if you have two of these out of these categories, then you're diagnosed with metabolic syndrome. And this is then the pre-stage for developing type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Now, in animal studies, we have shown that if you feed rats high-fat diet, they become, of course, obese. And if you then give our compound as a treatment every day, then you lower body weight.
Oh, my goodness.
And
even while they're having the fat.
Even while they're having the fat. And you also lower fasting plasma glucose.
Oh.
And this is good news, of course. But now we want to know the mechanism of these two effects. for that, we measure effects of our compound on endogenous metabolism.
So this is just metabolism that just happens?
Well, let's say glucose metabolism, lipid metabolism. Mm-hmm. And what we found, for instance, was if you look in people that have been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, they have abnormal lipid profiles. Now, if we then treat the rats with our compound, and this is, of course, these are different doses, then you see a dose-dependent reduction in these abnormal fats in our rat plasmas.
And how do you administer it to the rats, and how would you administer it to the people?
Well, we know now from kinetic studies that the half-life of a compound is about not quite a day.
Oh my goodness, so you've got to move quickly.
Now, actually a day, that means the half-life is about a day, so that means that it stays quite long in the body.
Oh, I see. After it's ingested, it stays that long.
It stays that long.
I was thinking of it being fresh versus taken out of the plant.
No. As if you have it as a pure compound, it is quite. You can keep it on the shelf for 10 years and nothing happens to it. It's not a problem. So we know, once a day dosing is sufficient. Normally you don't give rats capsules, you don't do that.
No.
You can give them actually with a syringe, you can squirt some in the mouth. We don't like to do that because that's very nasty for the animal. So what we do is we give them test meals.
Oh.
So what we do is we in the afternoon we remove the food from the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then by evening time, they're very hungry.
They're hungry.
So then we give them a small amount of food where we have added the xanthomimol at a predefined dose.
So they will eat it.
They will
sure.
eat all of it. So when they're done in 20 minutes, they have eaten it all, we know that they have gotten that particular dose. And we do that for 6 weeks. After 6 weeks, we measure the effects on the metabolism.
And in the human, then, this would be in a capsule.
This would be in a capsule. That's correct. Yeah.
Is it available now? No.
It is not available, but we, of course, this is an experimental material, so we have found a collaborator, meaning a pharmacy, that is making capsules for us.
Oh, I see. And that will be used in a study. You were just talking about
it. We have done one NIH-approved study. And this was not for measuring the effects, really. This was measuring absorption of the compound and measuring plasma levels to see if our compound, how it is taken up by the human body and how it's metabolized. And
so that it doesn't just pass through by body.
Right. Okay.
And it does stick with the individual, is metabolized along with other foods.
Exactly.
And it would probably be taken with other foods, I would imagine.
It can be.
And so the next step will be to study it in people, and you, I'm guessing, will want people who may be having some symptoms of...
Yes, we have designed a study, and we have submitted an application to the National Institute for Health, and this study will be, I guess, about 48 people, and those have been diagnosed with metabolic syndrome.
Oh.
So they can have one or more of these symptoms that I just described.
But will they be people who are taking some drug already or not?
In the initial study, they cannot be on any drugs.
Okay.
They cannot be. That is how it's been.
That makes sense.
And later, of course, we could study that too, but this is a first study. So in that case, we don't want any confounding or interactions or any...
No.
Anything that can cause trouble, we want to stay away from that.
Yes. Yeah, and that way, 48 individuals would be enough to
to do an initial first efficacy and safety.
And we've found in so many different areas that people are a lot like rats. Well, of course, we're all mammals. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
We
Wisdom of the Elders is committed to Native American cultural sustainability, multimedia education, and race conciliation. It especially seeks to correct misconceptions and prejudice, to bring health and wellness to Native people, and demonstrate how Indian culture has and is continuing to enrich our worlds. An Evening with Wisdom of the Elders, its second annual gala, is planned for Friday, June 21st, at 6:30 p.m. in the Rose Ballroom of the Ainsworth Event Center in Southwest Portland. The featured guest and keynote speaker will be Deanna D. Dart, Ph.D., Curator of Native American Art at the Portland Art Museum. Cedar Rose will perform a collaborative musical effort that focuses on traditional and contemporary Native American sounds formed by Karen Kitchen and Nico Wind. More information about this KABU-sponsored event may be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM, and it's now time for the news at noon.
For KBOO News at Noon, I'm Jimmy Tardy. The Turkish government has threatened to use the military to halt a general strike that has followed police crackdowns on protesters in Istanbul. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan claimed that the protests had been hijacked by what he called, quote, terrorists, saying that they would not be allowed to continue. The Turkish Medical Union reports that four protesters have been killed and 5,000 injured after 2 weeks of unrest in the country. Today's general strike was called by unions representing approximately 800,000 doctors, dentists, and engineers. Australia's Great Barrier Reef has been listed as endangered by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. The body establishes and assesses the protection of World Heritage Sites and meets this week in Cambodia. The group will consider whether a range of World Heritage Sites should be placed on the, quote, in danger list for next year. The announcement comes as the Australian federal government rejected a moratorium on new port developments in Queensland. The moratorium had been recommended by Australian Greens in order to protect the Great Barrier Reef at least until 2015, when a new review will take place. The Australian government says it is committed to protecting the reef,